So I often hear myself saying that we as human beings don't have any clue as to why we're here, that we don't really have any sense of what our purpose might be on this little planet. And today I think I'm going to take a different tack and say I know the answer to that. Not a small moment to have arrived at why we are here. But to talk about that, I want to take on the gospel a little bit and start with a story that is told in all three of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and in pretty much the same place in the story sequence. This story of journeys with Jesus and teaching, and then this incident where the disciples are arguing among themselves who is the greatest. And is there a more typical human activity than to be concerned about where we stand in relation to each other? How early and how relentless are the comparisons between us that we can rank each other and say where I stand in relation to you, and am I better than you? And what are the criteria that I use to establish my betterness? Is it money? Is it education? Is it appearance? Is it athletic ability? What are the criteria that I use for comparison? And then there are multiple. But what we're talking about here is this impulse. Who is the greatest? The strategies we have about comparing ourselves to each other. And then the recognition that this is simply a recipe for human unhappiness. That kind of comparison and that kind of judgment and that sort of competitiveness with each other really is a deeply mistaken project. And it begins with a kind of a false assumption or a false desire. And it's one of those situations where existentially, isn't it, from Maine that you hear, you can't get there from here. It's a quest of futility. And what is the quest? I think really it is the anxiety of not being able to hold on to anything. I mean, the basic anxiety that simply colors so much of what we do as human beings. We can't hang on to anything, which makes us radically insecure. And so we're always seemingly trying to figure out ways to mitigate that insecurity and put ourselves on a firm basis, something that will be secure. And everything that is done in the name of I am trying to be the greatest is what the Gospels would recognize as a false project, not to be condemned as if you're a bad person, but to be regarded with pity and compassion because you're on the wrong path. Now, the alternative that Jesus presents to the disciples today is to be a servant. And I would suspect that none of us hears the word servant and says, that's what I want my son to be. I aspire to be a servant. Do I want to be a lawyer, a doctor, or a servant? It's very slowly changing, but when the language of servanthood is used, I know that men and women hear that word differently. Typically, traditionally, women so often have been in roles of serving. They take care of children. They are preponderantly our teachers in elementary school. They are caretakers. And oftentimes that has been imposed on women to their diminishment. So servanthood is a complex notion. As it functions in the world, it is often merely a symptom of the dynamic that we began our sermon with. Who's the greatest? And if you're my servant, I'm greater than you. Isn't that true? If you're my servant, then I am greater than you. But Jesus says it's exactly upside down. The one who serves is greater. The one who serves is greater. And now, two examples of this. I often talk about this in Holy Week. But this notion that the one whose wisdom is greater, whose understanding is greater, that puts you in a place of service. The Christian, the great Christian example of that is Jesus washing his disciples' feet, which story we tell during Holy Week. And Jesus says, I think very poignantly, you call me Lord and Master, and rightly, for so I am. But this is how a Lord and Master truly acts. Washes feet. From the Buddhist tradition, we have the figure of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is, in a sense, a completely awakened being. However the Buddhists understand our human dilemmas, our suffering that is caused primarily from a mistaken understanding of who we really are. I mean, the Buddhists lean very heavily on this dynamic, who's the greatest? And if you try to make yourself the greatest, that is, in the Buddhist sense, the greatest confusion. And so the Bodhisattva is a completely awakened being, not afraid, not clinging, not trying to augment him or herself. And how does that awakened state express itself? The Bodhisattva vow is, beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. My work, in other words, is not done until every being experiences the same kind of freedom that I experience. Freedom from fear, freedom from anxiety, not holding on, not at odds with the basic conditions of our existence. Those are two examples. Jesus, Lord and Master, but scandalizing his disciples by literally acting as a servant, the one who would come in and minister to the guests. And then the Bodhisattva figure, the one where the Buddhist tradition recognizes the greatest wisdom is always in service of those who are not so wise, who are still caught in pain or fear or anger. So that's a more positive sense of what it really means to serve. It's, again, servitude. It's a central notion in the Bible. And I would also say it's a way of understanding how things go wrong. The figure who ought to serve, in the Bible stories, it's usually a steward set in charge of an estate. Take care of my lands, make sure my crops are grown. Order the estate. And what does the master goes away, and what does the servant do? The servant takes it for himself. He says, I want what the master has. So you have servants in revolt. I sometimes, you know, you may have heard various spiritual sort of traditions that speak of getting rid of your ego. I don't think the Christian tradition says that. I think the Christian tradition says the ego is a useful servant. It really helps carry out things. But again, we have this servant in revolt too, where my ego, my sense of who I am, I can start organizing my life, trying to make myself the greatest. And once again, that which ought to serve becomes a kind of a rebel. My ego has taken over my household and is now running the show. Oftentimes I think, you know, you hear of the church spoken of as the servant church, which I understand as this, well, everything we do here ought to serve the life we all share together in the world. It ought to serve that. Help us live more attentively, more compassionately. Serve that. But you know, the church has often said, no. You exist to serve us. You come, you bring your money, you bring, and we are in control. We are the greatest. So this notion of servitude, it has lots of bad examples. Bad examples where it represents the distortions of human power dynamics. You're my servant. You tell me what. I get to tell you what to do. Or ways where people or institutions or even psychological aspects are appropriately servants, but they want to take over the show. I said at the beginning, I often say we don't know why we're here. And today I will say the reason we are here is that we are servants. We are uniquely suited to be the servants, but then, of course, of what? Am I to serve you and simply help you get what you want without any sense of what project you're about? If you want to make $100 billion, am I going to give my one precious human life to help you do that? That would not be the Bodhisattva's understanding of service. That would not be Jesus' understanding of service. I'm not here simply to help you get what you want. The true servant is, as Jesus would be, as the Bodhisattva would be, I'm not here to help you get what you think you want. I'm rather here to help you understand who you truly are. For only in truly understanding who you are will your anxieties begin to diminish. Will you begin to experience what are perhaps your real gifts? Because when I say servant, I mean, I imagine we are so habituated to think of somebody living at the bottom level of Downton Abbey, taking direction from someone else. But I would say Nelson Mandela was a great servant. Ludwig Beethoven was a great servant. You know, there might have been days when he had to choose between playing a game on the internet and writing the Ninth Symphony. And, you know, okay, today I'm going to return again to the labor of writing the Ninth Symphony, because that's the gift that has been given to me, and I am going to serve that gift. It's a really important spiritual exercise to find out what you serve in your life. We all serve something. We all devote our lives to something greater than ourselves. We devote our lives to something. And it might be just to the project of making myself the greatest. And however you construe that greatness, it is a mistaken project unless the greatness you aspire to is a spiritual greatness. I want to be the most loving person that ever lived. I want to see things with the eyes of compassion. I want my heart to be open. You only do that. That is not a project that you do by yourself alone. Because the moment you speak about that kind of aspiration, what you're doing is you're turning your attention to something that we all have in common. We all share. And so the true purpose of human life is to serve the common good in recognition of that which every creature shares. See what we share. Live in response to that. Serve that greater reality. And you will find your own anxieties are calmed, and you will find the deep and really only fruitfulness open to a human being. To live in response to the great mystery in which all of us are alive, which sustains every one of us. Helping all creatures to come to that recognition will bring forth the greatest gifts in you as well, and your own peace and happiness will follow in its train.